Hoi hoi, good morning, and welcome to another edition of Big Mouth. Why did I say hoi hoi, guest Andrew Mueller?
Because as we just learned, that was Alexander Graham Bell's suggestion for a standard telephone greeting, which was later appropriated by C. Montgomery Burns.
Absolutely. So, hoi hoi, and welcome to another edition of Big Mouth, the pop culture talk show for the discerning time waster. My name's Andrew Harrison, and for some reason we have an unusually country and folk heavy show this week. We'll be talking about the sixth album from Laura Marling, the superstar of modern British folk, or is it alternative folk, or alternative traditional? I don't know what it is. What is Semper Femina all about, and is it any good? And what's behind Marling's extraordinary connection with her audience? We'll also be looking at next week's BBC4 documentary about the toweringly successful British country duo The Shires as they travel to Nashville and sign up with Taylor Swift's management in an attempt to sell Coles to Newcastle. Can you make actual whiskey-drinking, cousin-chasing music when you're from the Badlands of Hertfordshire and Bedfordshire? Also, we'll be TARDISing back to the Avenue 1990s as Sarah Cox presents the final instalment of BBC4's fan-centred People's History of Pop. In Closer Than Close, technology overturns every aspect of the music business. Was this a new beginning or a death knell for everything that made pop work? And, of course, we'll be hearing some of our guests' favourite songs at the moment. So let's meet those guests. The writer and broadcaster Laura Barton contributes to The Guardian, Q and BBC Radio 4, where she presents the much-acclaimed Notes from a Musical Island. She grew up in Newbury in Lancashire, which makes her a massive wall, but she has, you would never guess it, because she's got a lovely speaking voice. Newbury's closest big town is Ormskirk, where Les Pattinson from The Bunnymen and Richard Drummy of Go West grew up. I learned from Wikipedia. So
correct.
There we go, rock and roll Lancashire. Laura is a big folk head. Hello, Laura, how are you?
I am well, thank you.
What have you been up to lately?
I've been going to a lot of gigs, as usual. Went to see Mayla Jones last night. Went to see Alabaster de Plume recently. Saw Courtney Marie Andrews the other night.
Very nice.
Lots of nice musical things.
Also with us, you heard him earlier, it's Andrew Mueller, veteran of The Melody Maker and now an author, writer and presenter for Monocle 24. Also writes for The Guardian, The New Humanist and anybody else will have him. He is the author of a series of books, most recently It's Too Late to Die Young Now, an affectionate memoir of a youth gleefully misspent in rock journalism. He's done proper journalism too, covering the Taliban takeover of Afghanistan and the music scene in wartime Sarajevo. And he's a member of alt-country band The Blazing Zoos, whose new album Chocks Away is out now. As you will detect, Andrew is from Australia, specifically Wagga Wagga. Hello, Andrew. Welcome to Big Mouth. How are you doing?
Welcome. It is technically Wagga Wagga.
Wagga Wagga.
But I'll let it go.
There goes my on a Wagga tip gag there. What's the music scene like in at Wagga Wagga?
Quiet. It's fair to say. I have a mixed relationship with my birthplace, where I only lived for the first 6 weeks of my existence. But when you travel a lot, as I do, and that's stamped on your passport, it tends to come up, the conversation. Yeah. I mean, I do still have family there. I am an actual, genuine native son of Wagga Wagga, with a storied family history. They staged a musical about my great-great-grandfather in the town couple of years ago. Yeah, they actually did.
What did your great-great-granddad do?
His name was Charles William Buffer. He was the town auctioneer slash character slash drunk. A circus came to town, if I've remembered this story right. A circus came to town whose star attraction was a white bull so wild that no man could tame him. My forebear bet, I assume, a pub full of people that he would ride it down the main street of Wagga Wagga, which he did. Dame Mary Gilmore wrote a poem about this, which you can look up if anybody listening Googles Mary Gilmore and the man riding the white bull, they will see a poem written by one of Australia's great poets.
It's the kind of thing that you want to hear set to music by Nick Cave in a minor key.
It has been a disappointment with every new Nick Cave album that this has not yet been addressed.
Also joining us, completing the Big Mouth compliments as usual, he's recording us with an authentic using authentic free range electricity on a hand carved MacBook that used to belong to Dick Gochen. It is our producer of the Ewan McCullough podcast, Matt Hall. Good morning, Matt. How are you today?
I'm warm.
You're warm. Why?
It's warm.
Well,
it's warmer than it's been.
Spring is in
good.
The air. Yeah. Well, you know, you're not massively folk or country yourself, are you?
Actually, I kind of am on the down low.
You do have a beard.
I've got a beard and I'm fond of certain bits of folk and also certain bits of country.
Okay, right. Well, I can see I'm clearly outnumbered in the room here. Let's move on. Let's get started with Laura Marling. As I mentioned earlier, the alternative folk rock indie art performer Marling releases her sixth album this week. Semper Femina is a low-key and enigmatic record in which she looks at herself and femininity in general from a variety of intriguing angles. Before we talk about the album, let's have a listen. This track is Don't Pass Me By.
You see my oldest friend. Tell her that I'm gone.
Laura Marling with Don't Pass Me By from the new album Semper Femina. Okay, I was being a bit facetious there with all the folk stuff, but that was more a bit more like Portishead, I thought. And, you know, Dusty Springfield, the Dusty Springfield lilt in the voice. Laura Barton, where is Laura Marling at the minute in her arc?
In her arc? Well, she's just worked with Blake Mills, which I think is a really interesting producer to choose. I don't know if you're familiar with him. He is an American producer and musician, and he's an incredible guitarist. I encourage anybody to look out his song, Winter Song. And I think he's just a really interesting person for her to work with, rather than someone like Ethan Johns, who she's worked with a lot, and she produced her last album herself. He's just got a very different leaning, I guess, musically. And he isn't into words, and she's really into words. So I think that friction is quite interesting.
It's quite a sexual record, isn't
it? It's a very sexual record. This is one of the things that really annoys me, that a lot of people think about Laura Marling, that she's this fey, pretty little woodland fawn. And she's quite filthy sometimes. Or she's very womanly. She's very in control of her own body and her own mind, and quite fierce. And yeah, she talks about sex an awful lot in her records. This one particularly, but...
And this one, although called Semper Femina, she sort of puts herself in a male role, and sort of, you know, there's a key track, is it Nola? Where she's essentially writing this song of sort of...
Well, she said that she started off, it's about a female friend and looking at a female friend, but she said she started out writing the record as a man looking at women, and then she thought, why do I have to pretend to be a man? I am me looking at women. Mm. And I think she's sort of enjoyed looking at that zone that we don't often talk about, where women can admire other women, whether that's in a physical way or as a human being or whatever.
Mm. Andrew Mueller, what did you make of this album?
I tried repeatedly with Laura Marling many, many times before. I have a certain amount of difficulty, I think, seeing past, to borrow Laura's phrase, the fey, pretty little woodland fawn aspect of it. It's one of those things, and I think every music critic knows the feeling. It will happen to you. You will be asked to review an album, and you sit down and you listen to it, and you think, this is good. There is interesting things going on here. There is a sort of coherent sensibility at work. It is well played. The lyrics are well written. They can sing, etc. So you write the review of it up, you give it 4 stars, and then you never listen to it ever again. Laura Marling, and this is entirely my problem, not hers, for me, is one of those artists. I can see that it's good. I've listened to this album now half a dozen times, and I can barely remember a thing about it.
See, I've got pretty much the opposite reaction to this, because this is far from my thing. I mean, folk tends to send me running for the drum machines and the synthesizers. So I actually, first couple of listens, I did text Matt saying, God, I hope all the people are going to like this. Really, really hard work. Particularly,
I think your exact phrase was, I want to burn this onto a CD so I can fling it out of the window.
And then, as time went by, I've actually grown to really, really like it. So I've gone into the back garden and retrieved the CD. I've actually grown to really like it. But it is a sound world of its own. I'm sorry to keep harping on about the folk. There's not a great deal of folk here, is there?
She's so moved on from folk.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, and I think that's probably my problem than anybody else's. To me, it is of a part with Portishead and Björk and all the people who've come after that. I like the sparseness of it. Mm. I like the fact that it is produced with an awful lot of space. The thing that I couldn't deal with was when she suddenly lurches into this Americana accent. You're trying to make a liar out of me.
I think she's getting over. I mean, she's moved to Margate, so...
that explains it.
Yeah. Chaz and Dave coming up. Yeah.
In the next one. But yeah, she was living in LA, and I remember seeing her at End of the Road, and she was doing more of an American accent, and I thought, rein that in a little bit. Mm. But she's so young. I think it's sort of... She's so young, and she's finding her feet, and I think she's our greatest songwriter.
Well, that's what I find really exciting about all of her records is they're all actually kind of going back and listening to them for this. They're all really different. There's a real sense of kind of progression. But the thing it reminded me of, and not saying that this would be kind of like a ridiculous kind of comparison in many ways, but Joni Mitchell, in terms of how the tracks, the albums are kind of a whole but stand on their own. Absolutely. And so you like The Hissing of Summer Lawns, and you may not like one of the other albums,
I don't mind the accents thing so much. I think it's a... I can't remember who passed this theory on to me, but they said it was a demonstration of an innate musical ear if people start to absorb the accent that is around them, because you know they're taking it in, and it's not even conscious. But I think this runs through all of modern popular song, that there are some genres so... so associated with their particular geographical location that it's really, really hard. I mean, I'm about to make, I think, the first ever comparison of Laura Marling with Ian Astbury from The Cult. But he,
let's have it. Come on.
But he is the nonpareil example of that, of course. Like, you know, a sort of hearty hail son of Bradford who, when his band developed into a sort of strutting, leather-clad West Coast rock and roll monster, was all of a sudden shrieking, "Lord have mercy," in an accent I'm not even going to attempt to replicate.
Well, that isn't you know, all rock and roll is role play, isn't it?
It's
performance, and you know that's so people will take on. When I was a little kid, it used to puzzle me, why are they all singing in American? I know he's from England.
Well, it used to puzzle me, especially growing up in Australia, and I can remember it wasn't till really late '70s. I can remember what a big deal it seemed in the late '70s when the radio started playing K-San by Cold Chisel, which not only mentioned Sydney and was about a specifically Australian experience, or at least the Australian experience of Vietnam, but was being sung by somebody who sounded like he was obviously Australian. Hmm. It remains actually pretty unusual. There is, I think, a tendency to lapse into a transatlantic Esperanto. So I don't mind if someone like Laura Marling wobbles around a bit trying to adapt.
Laura, you're from the Northwest like me. What are the great examples of the Northwest accents in rock and roll? Because we've produced a load of bands.
Spiral Carpets.
Yeah. Sean William Ryder.
Yes, mm-hmm. Indeed. We've got quite a lot.
Mm. And even kind of like, you know, from Liverpool, there's, you know, I mean, there's definitely the Beatles.
Well, I don't think the Beatles sing in a Liverpool accent.
They do.
Oh, yeah, totally.
Really?
Early on especially, yeah.
Wrapping up on Laura Marling. I was surprised to eventually really, really like this record. I mean, it's going to stay on the phone. Okay, let's move on. Let's have some more music from a different source. Every week we ask our guests to come in with a tune each, something that they love right now. It can be older, it can be new, as long as it's to their editor's recommendation. Andrew Mueller, I believe you are keeping us off the drum machines and synthesizers also. What have you got?
I am. I'm bringing in a track by, well, not just my favourite band now. They've been my favourite extant rock and roll band for a long time now. This is Drive-By Truckers. Who I think just get more and more interesting. For those who are unfamiliar with them, the best way to describe them is that they are, to all appearances, an instant acquaintance, an old-school, ass-kicking southern rock band from the backwoods of northern Alabama. And indeed they are. But their lyrical outlook and their aesthetic outlook is... they're kind of essentially a bunch of soppy liberals. And what makes them interesting is that... everything they do is an attempt to reconcile their extremely mixed feelings about the United States in general, the South in particular. And they put out a very angry album this year called American Band, and this is a track therefrom. It's called Ramon Casiano, and one of the things I like about Drive-By Truckers is that you do actually learn stuff. I didn't know before I looked into this song that Ramon Casiano was a 15-year-old Mexican kid who was shot dead in 1931 by the then 17-year-old Harlan Carter, who went on to become the man who turned the NRA into what it now is. And this is the song.
Okay, well, let's have a listen. This is Drive-By Truckers with Ramon Casiano. Drive-By Truckers with Ramon Casiano, as chosen by our guest, Andrew Mueller. Okay, we're going to leave the trad stuff aside for a minute and talk about BBC Four ending its five-part People's History of Pop. This week, they opened the dreadful box marked 1997 to 2010, a.k.a. the years when it all went terribly wrong. Madfrit Ladette of the late 90s, Sarah Cox, fronted the show, which attempted to stitch together something coherent from a fractured period which comprised the Spice Girls, Radiohead, Trans Club Gatecrasher, Pete Doherty, and the game-changing arrival of social media. Did the show make sense, or are we at the end of the discrete, comprehensible era in pop music? First, to get in the mood, here's one of the pivotal acts from that documentary. This is Amy Winehouse with You Know I'm No Good. Meet you downstairs. Amy Winehouse with You Know I'm No Good from 2006, 10 years ago, which is making me feel ancient. It features in BBC4's People's History of Pop, Closer Than Close, 1997 to 2010, which went out on Friday night, but it's still on iPlayer if you fancy it. Andrew Mueller, this did feel a little like, oh no, we've got to do 13 years in one programme and wrap the series up. The conceit is a good one. It's you let the fans speak about their relationship with their idols rather than critics and pundits like us. Did it work as a documentary for you?
It kind of did. I think you can't go too far wrong when... If you find people who can actually talk and who can actually tell a story, you can't go too far wrong asking people about why does record X or artist X mean something to you.
Or also asking them, what's the most exciting thing that's ever happened to you in your life at the time I met my idol?
Indeed. I mean, anybody with half a brain in their head will be able to come up with quite an interesting answer to that. And some of it was really sweet. I mean, it was a weird period for me to watch, because I think I'm right in saying 1997 was when I got fired for what turned out to be the final time by the music press, as we once knew it.
Which
turned out to be an absolutely excellent moment to get binned by the music press.
Get out of this burning building. Get out!
I was like the guy, put off the Titanic, you know, sort of longboat with provisions the day before it hit the iceberg. You know, in retrospect, it worked out quite well. I quite liked it. I thought some of the stories were sweet. I loved the guy who made his own backstage pass to get into the press.
That was fantastic.
But that was brilliant. But it was also kind of, that just so couldn't happen now. Could you imagine? He'd be tasered within an inch of his life.
Laura Barton, this documentary, you're a fair bit younger than us. This documentary, this is your 20s, isn't it? This is you know, your pop youth.
Maybe.
Did it ring true?
Yeah, it did. I mean, none of those bands I was massively into, but it did. That fever of wanting to collect every bit of information about a band certainly did. I liked, actually. I think I get really fed up of those documentaries where it's people like us in this room being the talking heads.
We've got to pay the rent somehow.
I know. It's revenue just, stream to die. We all know how it works, I find it really disingenuous. I can't watch them. So I really liked seeing people who aren't used to being on TV or in any form of media talking about their love for Will. I mean, the Will Young stuff.
That was brilliant.
Yeah, because that was a woman just lost her husband.
Yeah.
And her daughter, and they just poured all of their life into supporting Will Young in Pop Idol.
People like me kind of veer from when watching this programme, like starting off with the guy who basically singly resurrected Travis's career, from going, thanks for that, and you're a brave man, to actually by the end going, that's a really sweet story. I mean, I think every one of those stories was brilliant.
For the people who haven't seen the documentary, essentially Travis are on their arse and
about to call it a day because of the terrible review
in the Melody Maker, I believe, and a fan writes to the Melody Maker and says, essentially, you know, believe in yourself, guys. And,
were you even know, at the same gig?
Absolutely. Who the hell do you think you are? And they read it. And it gives them heart, and they stick with it. And then ultimately, well, actually, I'm not giving away the punchline, because you might watch the documentary. There's a very, very sweet punchline to it. And it did make, you know, for me, it made me think that we probably underestimate the fact that fandom is the raw fuel, is the kind of the dark matter that makes the whole engine tick. Absolutely. You know, it can completely do without the likes of us. But
although my big problem with it was there was a glaring thing that happened in the guy who was a gatecrasher kid. Who talked about having really hard times and living in his car and living for the weekend, and then they cut to these shots of him at Gatecrasher, which was a big club in Yorkshire, in Sheffield, I think, at the turn of the century, where it was all day glow and it was all very kind of like the start of kind of really bosh techno. And correct me if I'm wrong, but the one time that I went to Gatecrasher when I was working at Radio 1 on the dance programmes, it was completely apparent that everybody in that very large room was completely off their tits on, at that point, I think, kind of a drug, an ecstasy tablet called Mitzis.
They were all on Mitsubishi.
And somehow, and despite cutting to loads of photos of this guy, quite obviously eyes on stalks, not coming down for a good few hours yet, there was no mention of...
Yeah, it was quite BBC.
Kind of, it was kind of an escapism, but it was hinted at, but there was no kind of like... And the best thing about it was the drugs.
A similar thing with the mention of the Libertines and Pete Doherty. There's a great bit where a fan goes, Pete Doherty is without doubt the most important and talented person of our generation. Oh, God bless you. But managing to cover Pete Doherty without mentioning the H word at all.
I was waiting for him to say, and he came around my house, and then the next thing I knew, my sofa had disappeared.
Yes.
You know, but
and
there
was
none of that.
To heroin. Yes. this was, but it was very BBC, wasn't it?
Yeah, I guess so. I think it's I think sort of looking at, it would have been good to look at what happened after this big flurry of attention from fans, because, you know, for me, that ruined the Liberty. I loved their first album. Thereafter, they irritate the hell out of me because they never fulfilled their potential. And it's partly that crush of being told that you're amazing.
What I found interesting was that the relationship changes, not in the sense that the star, you know it, everything about the stars and the stars know everything about you, becomes a very one-dimensional relationship of just praise. So at the start of this 1997 period, you've got a kind of a bestiary of nutcases and weirdos with stupid haircuts and crazy ideas. And by the end of it, it's just people offering up their cover version of Adele songs for Adele to say that's lovely and everybody hugs and cries. And that's become the relationship.
That's exactly what I mean about the Libertines. I think if they'd had more critical filtering, they would be much better songwriters. And I think that's
plenty
a shame.
I'd
have given them some critical filtering.
Critical filter. I mean, that's what you need. I'll critical filter you, Doherty.
Exactly. They made several records that I would have critically filtered within an inch of their wretched lives.
Let's have some more music. Laura Barton, what tune have you brought in for us to listen to?
I brought in a tune by a band called Hers, and I first saw them when I was a judge for Green Man Rising, which is the new band thing for Green Man Festival last summer. And Tom Ravenscroft and I voted for this band to win, and everyone else voted for someone else, and the other person won. But we loved this band. It's a duo. I think one's from Norway and one's from Barrow, but they met in Liverpool. And there's a sort of distinctive Liverpool jangle to a lot of the stuff they do. But they're so compelling live. They're so unlikely to look at. And they just seem to be having the time of their lives. And it's just brilliant, boyish, sort of raggedy rock and roll.
Okay, what's it called?
This one's Speed Racer, I think.
Okay, they've met in Liverpool, so this is Speed Racer by Hairs. That was the Rockahula sound of Speed Racer by Hairs, as chosen by Laura Barton. So, we're going to talk about another BBC 4 documentary, this one going out next week. The Shire's New Country looks at the surprising rise of British country duo Chrissie Rhodes and Ben Earle, the first British country band to get a UK top 10 album. The documentary follows them as they attempt to replicate the success in the USA with a trip to Nashville, a deal with Taylor Swift's manager, and a snapshot of where the US country scene is at right now. Before we talk about it, here are the Shires with their signature hit, Nashville Grey Skies. Worst Like Country. That was The Shires with Nashville Grey Skies, which is literally about making country music in rainy Britain. Now, I am totally out of my wheelhouse here. The only country music I like is Johnny Cash, which is, of course, a massive, massive cliche. But Laura Barton and Andrew Mueller know their way around a twang or two. Laura Barton, what has made The Shires so popular? Has the country audience changed?
I think it has. I'm doing a piece about this at the moment. I think it's partly the Taylor Swift effect, it's partly the internet making the world smaller, it's partly the TV show Nashville. I don't know that... I don't want to slag off the Shires necessarily, but I'm not... That is not my world of country, really, so I'm not too
It is massively, massively sort of commercial and all... Well, I mean, Taylor Swift is homeopathic country, isn't it? It's a tiny, tiny little bit of it left in there, but really it's pop music.
Yeah.
This struck me, you know, I grew up with me dad playing John Denver all the time kind of thing. And this, to me, is the, you know, it's so kind of, you know, presenting you with the idea of country. This is what country is supposed to be. This is what it's supposed to be twangy. It's supposed to have all those little vocal ticks and licks. I don't want to get into a, you know, is this real proper music thing, but it's, are real country fans buying this?
Yes, and I was speaking to the people who organise the festival, and they're talking about how sort of revered that is now in Nashville. So in the Country Music Awards, there's a representative from the Country Music Festival over there, because it's such a huge audience now. So I think Americans are liking our interpretation
of it. There always has been, though, hasn't there? That I can remember kind of during the 70s, you'd get kind of big... They used to be on BBC Two, I think. There used to be a big kind of country and western festival at Wembley, and they used to kind of film it and put it on at half hours on kind of like Saturday night or whatever. So there always has been a really big kind of audience. And don't forget, kind of Dolly Parton and Tammy Wynette had massive hits.
Yeah, but I mean, there's something authentic, you know, about Dolly Parton and Tammy Wynette, although it might be rhinestoning to death. I mean, to me, what strikes me about the Shires as a band is this is like alt country. This is the alternative to alternative country.
It struck me as their idea of Nashville. It seems entirely tied to Nashville in inverted commas, i.e. the wretched but weirdly compelling television series. As I was saying earlier, I am getting terrifically old, and so because I'm getting terrifically old, I find it incredibly hard to begrudge clearly very nice people who have worked really hard becoming successful. And the Shires come across from this documentary as clearly very nice people who are working very hard, and I wish them the absolute best of luck. But dear Lord, their records are boring. I mean, it is so incredibly dull. And speaking as a massive country music nerd, and almost certainly as a consequence a massive country music snob, the thing I just kept thinking was of the extraordinary, vast, rich, sprawling tapestry of country Americana music as it now exists, of all the things you could possibly be listening to if you wanted to listen to music of that sort, why would you listen to the Shires? I also have is it an unreasonable grudge? I'll let the listeners decide. I have a thing about non-American country bands in particular giving themselves names which are desperately authentic and Americana, and the Shires does kind of I just kept thinking of Shire horses. I mean, I'm possibly projecting. I mean, the documentary's
kind of... Yeah, Shire horses aren't an American thing. Yeah, Shire horses are an English thing.
It's the Hobbit.
Well,
it's your neck of the woods. It's the Antipodes.
Okay, so perhaps that theory's falling. My prejudice stands. I may excuse the Shires from it. But I don't know, the documentary itself was also the kind of, cliche day trip Nashville tour guide. I mean, have them playing at the Bluebird, although in the interest of disclosure, I should admit I have literally done that myself.
where's your date with Taylor Swift?
Well, exactly.
My favourite character in it is the shark-eyed manager of Taylor Swift, who basically, they go to Nashville to kind of sign with his, to see about signing with his management company. And he just, you know, he's just got that kind of dead behind the eyes.
That thing is like, yeah, your song's great. Love your song. Not keen on the music, not keen on the lyrics. We might have to change those, but other than that, the song's
and also
fantastic.
The vocals. Can you go to this guy?
Yeah, I don't like the vocals and I don't like the instruments. Other than that, I think it's a great song and we can do a lot with it.
Laura, what did you make of it as a documentary? Because I mean, I think Andrew's kind of right, isn't he? It's a bit of a boring story.
So boring. There are so many documentaries these days about musicians that just simply don't need to exist.
One could argue there's so many musicians.
Well, that's true. But don't then double it and make a film about them.
There's the bit in the film where the male member of the Shires says, you know, I never did drugs, so I can't write about that. And I'm kind of going, but
please,
that's do. Yeah, that's why kind of songs are a little bit meh.
I kept thinking over and over of that Waylon Jennings song about Are You Sure Hank Done It This Way, which is about, you know, where he's sort of saying, at that point, Nashville is not about rhinestone and all this kind of stuff. And I had that recurring thought.
The Shires are the absolute living definition of how Hank didn't do it.
Yeah. In the documentary, there's a bit of a kind of a crack in it where for a moment we see a bit about the ugly phenomenon of bro country where it's just like poundingly sexist. And then there's also a great bit where we meet an artist called Sarah Shrucker, who I'd never heard of. And she's talking for like 30 seconds about what about country really is punk rock and how country shouldn't be cleaned up and sold and made pleasant and made easy for the radio. And it's wrapped up and done in 30 seconds. And suddenly Taylor Swift's manager is back saying, hey, well, it's okay as long as it's successful. And I thought that in that 30 seconds, there's your documentary.
I know, it's fascinating.
Excitement and weird people doing weird things.
And the fact that country music has had this cycle before, you know, it sort of went to this really bombastic and ostentatious thing, I think, 80s, I'm sure Andrew
will call it. 80s hat music, as it was known, yes.
And it is interesting to see people like Sturgill Simpson, Courtney Marie Andrews, who I've mentioned, Erin Lee Tazjian, who I think is a really exciting, quite psychedelic performer. They're coming through. And, you know, Sturgill's won Grammys this time around, which is inspiring in itself. So I think...
But he comes over and he plays kind of the end of the road or whatever. He doesn't play this festival, which is happening at the moment.
No, and that's why I'm looking forward to seeing this weekend, but I'm slightly fearful at the same time.
What I found disappointing about it was that it was a really tedious business story that could actually have been about any part of the music business. Mm-hmm. And there was nothing about what the music expresses, how it resonates with people. And, you know, there was one little bit where you see a sign outside a vocal coach's place saying, make singers great again. Like, it is a tumultuous time in American culture. Country is the music of the red states, the 50% of America. Well, that is. But the thing, where was the American carnage that we hear about?
One of the many interesting things about country music is that it is the music of the red states, and yet it actually isn't as well. It has always had this kind of angry liberal tradition, which this goes back as far as Johnny Cash, who sang protest songs about the Vietnam War, as far back as Willie Nelson, who has admittedly been permanently stoned since the Eisenhower administration, but is representative of a liberal undercurrent. Drive-by truckers being, you know, the obvious modern standard bearer of that. I think the Trump era, which hopefully won't last that long, but nonetheless will be interesting in all sorts of ways, most of them not good, but it will be interesting to see what the response to it is and to what happens is from, you know, this most American of music. So it's funny, I saw Drive-By Truckers in Brighton on Saturday night and was speaking to them afterwards, and they'd said they'd released this incredibly angry record last year and thought, yeah, we've probably got 3 months to absolutely milk this before Hillary Clinton gets elected and everything kind of goes back to normal. And now they're just going, well, I said, well, you know, I don't really know what we do next, because they've made their big angry State of the Union address, and it's just been overhauled by events.
Well, there'll be some more material along very, very quickly, I should imagine.
Indeed.
Yeah. Okay, so we're coming up to the end of the show, which means it's time for some closing time chatter. This is when our guests share the stories or the ideas that are exciting them or driving them mad this week. Laura Martin, I believe that Alan Titchmarsh has been playing on your mind.
As usual.
I picked Alan Titchmarsh. No, I didn't.
I just was reading this interview, or this piece, where he'd, after, I think, at the literary festival, he'd apologised for decking and his part in the decking mania of the 90s. And I just started thinking, as I sometimes do, about what are going to be the equivalent trends of decorating and things. For now that we're going to think, what were we thinking?
What are we going to be apologising for, do you think?
It's that sort of coffee shop reclaimed look, I think we're all
whimsy. It's going to start looking really embarrassing.
What, old crap from the side of the road put on a mantelpiece because it's interesting.
That McDonald's have their sort of equivalent ones, I think that's...
Well, I don't like the fact that you can't go and get a sandwich now without getting splinters from the reclaimed wood table or a snag on your jumper, you know. I want some nice, like, formica, I think, would be lovely.
Think formica and something that's not sort of gentrification grey would be nice.
Actually, this relates to something that we've moaned about on the podcast in the past, is artificial artisan things, like shops called Scoff and Banter, and Cutter and Squidge.
Anything and anything.
Made up things like that. Yeah. You know, just I want there to be a food shop just called Food Outlet. And the menu just says meat, chicken.
I'd like just those old things we had in the 80s where it's just freezer centres and everything. You didn't really know what you were picking up because it was just covered in layers of ice, but that was your tea.
Absolutely.
It's probably cod in butter sauce.
There could be a revival of plain speaking. I went past a theatre many years ago in Branson, Missouri, which, for people unfamiliar with it, is kind of a, I don't know what you'd call it really, sort of a,
I've been to Branson,
it's a strange sort of semi-professional Las Vegas, but one of the theatres, it is basically where
where country artists go to die.
It's full of people you assumed you were dead. Like I was there in 2008. In one day, I saw the Osmond Brothers, Roy Rogers Jr. and Andy Williams. Just like back to back, but there was one particular theatre, and it was a plain white building, and painted on the outside in huge blue letters, you could see half a state away, was the slogan "Shows and Food."
Excellent. I would go there.
Yeah, you totally know what you're getting.
Excellent. Andrew Mueller, what's your own closing time chatter?
It's a bit niche because I've been attempting to read pretty much the entire literary canon associated with the national sport of my homeland, which is Australian rules football. The reason I'm doing this is that I'm in the process of making my own contribution to the canon of literature about Australian rules football. Hello, HarperCollins, if you're listening. I do realise I'm about a year behind deadline. It is kind of interesting. A lot of it is obviously terrible. It's sort of like ghost-written first-person memoir by, you know, cashing in former footballers. Some of it's really good. I read a book which I want to give a particular plug. It was edited by two Australian authors called Alicia Sometimes and Nicole Hayes. And it's a collection of writing called From the Outer. But it's reflections on Australian rules football written by the people you don't normally get to hear from. So it's sort of pieces about the game and their relation to it, written by women, written by gay people, written from by people from ethnic minorities in Australia, and it's genuinely fascinating about what the game has meant to people, both as a way of making them feel included and a way of making them feel excluded. Right. If you live in Melbourne, if you don't know Melbourne in particular, it's really hard to it's hard to compare the dominance of one city by one sport with anything anywhere else. If people think people in London are crazy about soccer, as we call it, they have no idea. Mm. Melbourne, it just sucks the life out of absolutely everything. The season's about to start in 2 weeks. But that was one of the most interesting collections of literature I've read. I'd also like Bob Murphy, the captain of the current Premier team, Murphy's Law. He writes a column for The Age, which was collected in this book. But I'm looking forward to his next one because he was... I'll keep this short. The team he plays for are the traditional strugglers from the western suburbs. They had not won the premiership since 1954. They had not been in the grand final since 1961. They won the thing last year against all odds with an injury count that looked like the Light Brigades. And he had had to watch the entire season from the sidelines after popping his knee quite early on. So on the one hand, he is the captain who brings the club back to glory, and on the other hand, he's had to sit there and watch it. And I think his book, he's a very smart man and a very good writer, his book about that will be fascinating.
Well, nobody comes to Big Mouth for the mainstream stuff, so we'll keep it on the niche there.
Can I just ask, wasn't Alicia Sometimes the B-side of Primal Scream's first single?
Almost certainly. I suspect it's not the name on her birth certificate, but I do recommend that book, From the Outer.
Yeah. Matt Hall, what have you got for your closing time chatter?
Leaving aside the earth-shattering fact that I discovered on the way to the studio that Biggie Smalls, Notorious B.I.G., died 20 years ago last Thursday in L.A., as did Terry Nation, which I wasn't on the same day, same city.
Are these facts connected?
I find it, you know, there's a definitely a kind of Tupac, Biggie,
it'll be on the
Terry.
It'll be on the internet. Yeah.
But there was, I listened to a show by a mate of mine called Ross Allen. He hosts a show on NTS Radio, and this is still available. He had the fantastic music industry guru Joe Boyd in the show last week, and I didn't realise that. I knew that Boyd had done loads of stuff in the 60s with kind of folk rock in the UK. I didn't realise that he kind of got then went over to the States and worked in the film industry, putting music together with films for, I think, Warner Brothers. And he told a story of him putting dueling banjos into Deliverance. Which is really interesting. That bit's interesting. But the bit that was brilliant was that Phil Spector's, after it became a massive hit and the film came out, Phil Spector's secretary rang up Joe Boyd and said, oh, it's Phil's birthday in a couple of weeks. And Phil wants the kid from the Deliverance movie to come and play the banjo at his birthday party. And Joe Boyd had to go, well, he actually didn't play it. It's actually a 33-year-old Jewish New Yorker who played dueling banjos. And the woman went, oh, okay. And she put the phone down. And then about 10 minutes later, she rang back and goes, now, I've spoken to Phil, and he says he knows music and he knows film, and that kid played the banjo in the film. It's just... Is that the first instance of... It's not the first instance, but another instance of Spectre's quite mad insanity.
Yeah, well, my closing time chatter, you'll be absolutely surprised to learn that I'm incredibly excited about the return of the original Cybermen in the next series of Doctor Who. Stephen Moffat and Peter Capaldi have clearly decided it's their last series. They're just going to do the B-sides for the fans. They're just going to go all out, do whatever they want. So they're bringing back the Cybermen from 1966, who look like they're made out of tea towels and bits of old stuff you found lying around in the garage, plastic tubing, bin bags. They've got, like, horrible human hands. They are the best, most terrifying rubbish monsters. You could make it yourself with whatever you can find lying around in the garage. And to me, this is obviously because I'm a massive nerd, it's very exciting to see this thing we haven't seen in 50 years in colour at long last. But also, I think it is actually the direction for the future. Handmade crap, artisan Cybermen is what we want, because you can now do pretty much anything you want with special effects and make it look real. Oh, here's the Cybermen. They look like $1 million. So much better. They look like an angry tea towel.
An angry tea towel. You could take it further, and you know, like election night when they have all their sort of fandango.
Just
make them themselves as well.
Yeah, well, or like, do you remember Alan Partridge's 1994 World Cup measuring machine when it's just fallen to bits? Because here's my, it's for my summer of sport. I think it should be like that. Yeah. I think the swingometers should fall off in Dimbleby's hands.
Yeah.
The weather, they should have to stick magnetic clouds back up. Here's some sun. Oh, no, it's fallen. Oh, there's going to be sun in Cornwall. Cornwall instead of Scotland, oh dear. All that. I've had it with high end. I want sticky back plastic. Get your parents to help you with the scissors. Keep it cheap. That's going to be Brexit Britain for you.
Yeah.
Austerity. Absolutely. Okay. Well, I think we're done, aren't we, for another show. Thanks to our guests, Andrew Mueller of The Guardian and Monocle 24 and The Blazing Zoos. What are you up to next, Andrew?
We have shows with the band. We are opening for Case Harden in Staines, I think, on the 23rd of March. And we are playing at Alan Tyler's Always Excellent Come Down and Meet the Folks at the Apple Tree in Clerkenwell on the afternoon of Sunday, March 26th, or whatever the last Sunday in March is.
Okay. And thank you to Laura Barton, also of The Guardian and BBC Radio 4. Now, you just said your next series of Notes from Musical Ireland is coming up soon?
It's June. We're about to start recording.
Okay. What kind of places are you going to be going to?
Oh, we're going to Cornwall, the Isle of Egg, and Belfast.
The Isle of Egg. Amazing. Okay, so remember, you can hear this show again, if you wish, and also all of our episodes from the past. You can get them on our archive at audioboom.com/channel/bigmouth. Or, if you would like to subscribe, you can go to the iTunes Music Store. Go and find podcast down at the bottom of the opening page. Click and search for us. Subscribe and you will get the podcast a day early. You'll get it on the Saturday so you can impress all the kids. And, of course, if you would be so kind as give us a star rating, a good one, that helps us get up the charts and helps get the word out. Thanks for listening. Matt and I will be back next week. Until then, let's have a track by one of our guests for a change. Don't knock the PRS or 1p of it. By Andrew Mueller's country band The Blazing Zoos. This one's called Bob Chitty's Blues. Andrew, what's the story behind this?
Well, wrapping us up nicely, this is a country song about an Australian rules footballer.
it's for everybody.
It's almost as if you planned it.
Exactly. It's an imagined monologue from an imagined interior monologue from inside the head of Bob Chitty, who was the captain of Carlton in the 1945 Grand Final, which is remembered in history generally with a shudder as the bloodbath. But there is an extraordinary story. It was violent even by the standards of the game of the era. But there is an extraordinary backstory to it, which was that Bob Chitty, though he was known as the league's resident hard man during the war, had four brothers who actually went away to war, one of whom was killed at Tobruk, two were taken prisoner in North Africa. One was taken prisoner by the Japanese at the fall of Singapore, Peter Chitty. But I didn't know until I started looking into this that the prisoners in the Changi Prisoner of War Camp, actually, who included a number of actual league footballers, set up their own competition while they were there. And at the end of it, a prize was given to the best player in the league, the so-called Changi Brownlow, named after the VFL's actual Brownlow medal. And the only one ever awarded was to Peter Chitty, who was later decorated for bravery for, you know, literally carrying a malaria-stricken comrade up the Burma Railway on his back. So the imagined psychological underpinning is that the game became so violent because it was the players on the field who hadn't served trying to impress the returned servicemen, my grandfather among them, in fact, who had returned. And that's what the song's about.
Blimey. That's just the chorus.
Absolutely, yes.
So, yeah, you can all sing along. It's really simple.
Here we go. Well, violent even by Australian standards. This is The Blazing Zoos with Bob Chitty's Blues. We'll see you next week. Bye-bye.
My mother calls me Robert. My teammates call me Bob. You best not call me anything if you're with South Melbourne.